Hey, everyone. If you like this podcast, you should check out the full finance journey at realvision.com/RVpod to get the full view of what Real Vision is all about. A video on demand platform you can watch anywhere. Our members get daily videos and analysis, plus access to more than 3,000 videos for beginners and experienced investors alike, and live events online. You'll join the most thoughtful community in finance. More than 300,000 people who trust Real Vision to be the anchor to truth in the financial world. To get started, visit realvision.com/RVpod and use the promo code PODCAST10 to get 10% off our essential membership for your first year. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It is now officially summer since we are now live on air on June 1st, 2022. I'm joining you here live from Copenhagen, Denmark, and my name is Andreas Steno Larsen. And today I'm very, very happy to present my guest of the hour, a friend of mine and the founder of CEO of 42 Macro, Darius Dale. A warm welcome to the show.
What's up, brother? How you doing, man?
I'm all good. It's good to see you again. It's
last week you were on my show this yet today, and now we're here on the briefing. I mean, you know what they say about the third date, right?
Oh, Jesus. We just can't get enough. Let's put it like that. We've had a pretty nice day on markets, I'd say, at least from an action packed perspective. Equities are slightly down on the day, even with a slight late comeback here. But we've also had natural gas on the move again in commodity space. I find that interesting. And then thirdly, we've seen bond yields jumping again after a very strong ISM manufacturing print earlier today. And you told me before we went on air that this was kind of a middle finger to your current growth thesis, because it essentially surprised to the upside this growth gauge. What do you make of the numbers we got from the ISM report today?
It was a healthy report. I mean, obviously accelerating is one factor, but just the general level of this time series continues to tell you that the US economy is still operating comfortably above trend. And that's been our, we have to go from above trend growth to below trend growth, not only in reported terms, but also in expectations terms. And that process continues to underpin our negative views on risk assets.
Yeah. So it came in above 56, the index level today, which is a quite healthy level. But if you look 3-6 months ahead for the ISM manufacturing, what kind of levels would you envisage that we will hit?
I mean, so it's hard to forecast ISM with any room. I think getting the directional trend right and ultimately getting the inflection points right are probably going to be more value added in terms of the amount of time you spend as an but one thing I would forecast in terms of, you know, you look at our USA grid model, Brian, if you throw that chart up there, this is something I've been saying all year, which is if you really want to get into the teeth of the slowdown, our model is not projecting that real sort of, you know, meaningful deceleration in the pace of growth commencing until you get into the July, August, September months. So basically Q3 is where you're going to really start to see growth slow at a much faster pace. We've been slowing, but at a very modest pace of slowdown. And it's been very negligible from the perspective of asset markets. A lot of what's gone on thus far has really just been the inflection in the liquidity cycle. What we do have is another shoe to drop, and that's the growth cycle really picking up steam to the downside. It's already baked in the cake. We can talk about why. And we also have the profit cycle picking up steam to the downside as well as a function of the growth slowdown.
Yeah. One of the things that I like to look at when I'm trying to assess the development ahead for the ISM manufacturing figure is the developments that we've seen over the past year in interest rates. I've brought my model today, if you can show it on the screen, Brian, showing that if you use the 2-year point and the 10-year point on the US yield curve as a gauge of where ISM manufacturing is headed, you actually have a very decent forecasting model showing the direction 1 year ahead. And right now, we are basically staring directly into the next cyclical slowdown phase if this interest rate-based model holds true. So assuming that this model holds true, we should probably see levels below 50 by the end of this year in the ISM manufacturing. And this is very interesting when we debate bond yields. I know that you've slowly but surely turned positive on bonds again, Darius. But the growth cycle is, of course, one important ingredient in that perspective. What do you make of bond yields post this number we got today on the ISM manufacturing report?
Oh, totally. I think it's to me, this today was such a important day for the notebook. You don't get them every day, but every once in a while, the market will signal something to you that I think is very important to write down. And to me, what was very important to write down was the market response to such good data. And it sort of tells you that, to me, I think it's a real clear signal and an indication that there's no real easy way out of here from the perspective of risk assets. And what I mean by that is the fact that financial conditions, they continue to remain uncomfortably loose. In fact, Brian, if you could put up that chart titled Financial Conditions Remain Uncomfortable, showing in that chart is the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index. That's the red line in the chart. The black line in the chart shows the S&P 500's next 12 months earnings yield. So taking the AE divided by the P. And you see from both the indicators, you know, we're nowhere near what we've historically seen the Fed pivot. We're nowhere near where we've historically been at the bottom of a growth cycle slowdown. And so it tells you, look, if we continue to see strong data, the obvious implication of an economy that is still operating above trend from a demand perspective is that inflation is not going to behave anytime soon. And that's going to keep the Fed actively engaged and perhaps more engaged in removing liquidity. And one final part on that last point. On the next chart, Brian, is the dollar, euro, and British pound OIS, where we're showing overnight index swap forwards for those different currencies. In the top panel, we just show the sort of higher low that's starting to be put in dollar OIS, if you look at it on a one-year and two-year basis, up 17 basis points day over day. And so telling you that, hey, look, maybe the market got too far ahead of itself in pricing in, you know, a shallow terminal Fed funds rate, pricing in a September pause, if you will, according to Bostic, down at the Atlanta Fed. And maybe the real answer is inflation does not behave anytime soon, and the Fed continues to keep its foot on the brake, if not press the brake down a little harder.
We've had a couple of Fed speakers out today, one of them being Bullard, maybe the most hawkish member of the committee. I told my clients late last year that Bullard was actually worth listening to when he was one of the first members of the committee stating that the Federal Reserve needed to taper asset purchases throughout the autumn of last year. What do you make of his comments today referring to the credibility aspect of inflation?
Yeah, great question, man. And we talked about this podcast on Sunday. The Fed is fighting two wars right now. It's fighting a reported inflation battle that it's clearly losing at the current juncture, and it will continue to lose over the medium term. Eventually, they'll get it right. But I think the just as important is the battle with respect to their credibility. And this is part of the reason why we saw Fed Chair Powell address the American public. It's part of the reason why we saw the photo op in the White House yesterday between President Biden, Jay Powell, and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who also had comments today. But I'll finish on Bullard's comments before we pivot to her. Bullard said, and I'm quoting this situation, obviously he's talking about inflation, is risking the Fed's credibility with respect to its inflation target and associate mandate to provide stable prices in the U.S. And so this is, again, this is an institution that's wounded by a very, very publicly very bad forecast that is now the result of that forecast. That bad forecast is now hurting tens, if not hundreds of millions of Americans at the gas pump, at the dinner table, at the grocery, you know, the clothing outlet, et cetera, et cetera. And then lastly, pivoting to Yellen's comments, it's very much along the lines of this credibility dynamic where she said, I was wrong about the path inflation would take, citing her comments last year that inflation would be transitory. It obviously is not transitory. And now you have a lot of very important individuals as it relates to a voter on the FOMC, the FOMC Fed chair himself, the Treasury Secretary Yellen, and obviously the President of the United States, all coalescing to drain liquidity from financial markets, to suck out demand from the economy. And ultimately, that's going to have an impact on the profit cycle.
Yeah. And if the Federal Reserve will have to act very aggressively to bring down demand, then we may be faced with a very severe economic slowdown this coming autumn. And in that regards, the CEO, sure.
He acted very aggressively to bring down.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
We are back on air. We apologize for the technical issues we just faced here. We were talking about the potential economic hurricane coming up. Those were the words used by the CEO of JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon, earlier today. It's very, very rare that you see a CEO for a big bank saying stuff like that, Darius. What do you make of his comments and the severity of them?
Yeah, no, I thought it was very interesting. You know, you don't tend to see someone whose business is so positively correlated to the economic cycle effectively tell you that, hey, look, this is going to get a lot worse for me, and therefore it's obviously going to get a lot worse for you. It's a very atypical behavior of a bank CEO. You don't hear it very often. So I think it's very telling. You know, we don't want to get into the business of using Jamie Dimon or, you know, Lloyd Blankfein used to be, or Brian Moynihan or any of these other CEOs as leading indicators, because at the end of the day, you know, their models are they're only as good as their models, right, in terms of forecasting. But one thing I will say is that I certainly do agree with them. Now, the size of the hurricane, the category of the hurricane ultimately need to be assessed, which is obviously the title of the show. Are we headed for recession? I think it's way too early to tell if we're headed for recession, because we have to get to a below trend growth state to see the kinds of shocks that are, you know, being accumulated to the system at that moment in time. All we know is that, hey, we're going to go to a below trend state of growth. A couple of numbers I'll throw at you before we go to questions. You know, if you look at the real PCE data that we got on Friday, I thought it was pretty telling to see the sort of pace of deceleration that is already starting to accumulate. You know, if you look at the headline real PCE, that's the broadest measure of consumption in the economy. It's about 2/3 of U.S. GDP. That accelerated to 2.8% on a year-over-year basis last month, or in April. These data are one month lag. But the 3-month annualized rate of change actually slowed to 1.2%. So basically, less than half of where the year-over-year is. And so, if we stay at this level of growth, which you could argue we're probably not going to stay at this level of growth, they're going to actually go lower. We're going to see a pretty significant slowdown in the year over year. And more importantly, where you're supposed to see a booming economy, the services sector, yes, that's, you know, still running at about 6% year over year, 5.9 to be exact. But on a 3-month annualized basis, services consumption is only at 1.8%. And that is a big problem in the context of everyone saying, hey, look, transitioning from goods to services, booming economy, et cetera.
Yeah. And one of the things that, of course, comes with an economic recession is usually a rising unemployment rate. And I wanted, before we move to the questions, to pick your brain on the employment leg of the ISM manufacturing report we got earlier today, because that was actually the part surprising to the downside. What do you make of the contractionary numbers we got on employment in the ISM report?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's somewhat telling. I mean, it's telling you that they were seeing a ebbing of demand for labor. That number came in around 49.6, lowest number we've seen since November of 2020. And so clearly we're starting to see some cracks, you know, at the margins in the labor market, but we have so much slowing to go. I mean, don't forget the labor cycle, the labor market in general, employment growth, these are all lagging indicators to the broader economic cycle. And so we're going to be talking about a slowdown in employment a year from now. I mean, so let's keep that in context. What's more likely to happen is the leading indicators start to, you know, continue to slow. We'll start to see coincident indicators like things like, you know, retail sales, industrial production, et cetera, really start to slow. And then we'll start to see a real significant slowdown in employment growth. But I do believe this might be a very, very early leading indicator for that process, which will, again, play out over the next 12 to 18 months.
Yeah. We've got a bunch of questions and a very, very good one here relating to the debate that we have on the economic slowdown in the US, because the role of the US dollar during an economic slowdown is one of the topics that are always debated when we enter such a slowdown. What do you make of the dollar level heading into such a slowdown?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is a unique cycle in the sense that the dollar showed some pretty aggressive strength in the growth cycle upturn, you know, if you call it from 2020 to 2021 and throughout 2021 and into the other part of 2022, or obviously into recent weeks, you know, this is pretty atypical. Typically, you see a pretty significant decline in the dollar. We got that significant decline in the dollar going back to the summer of 2020, but, you know, really kind of started to bottom out in early part of 21 and really started to take off in 2020, you know, in mid 2021. And it's telling me that, hey, look, in this COVID world, where the U.S. stimulated significantly more than all of its peers, growth significantly outperformed more than its peers, profit growth, et cetera, GDP, et cetera. There's been a lot of capital inflow into the U.S. economy. I mean, if you look at it on a sort of annual basis, last year we saw $4 trillion of capital going into the U.S. economy if you look at the change in our net international investment position. And so that to me says, hey, look, if we have a significant slowdown in growth, typically that favors dollar strength. That's usually a sign of a reduction in global liquidity that tends to cause, you know, a lot of short covering and a lot of prepayment at international debt capital markets, you know, for a lot of the dollar denominated debt out there. But the reality is you could actually see the dollar go in reverse if we have a significant slowdown, because what's really been happening is all that capital has been capitalizing our excess growth rates. And so I'm not really sure, but, you know, we actually booked a decent gain in our long dollar position. We've been long the dollar for a really long time in recent weeks. And we, you know, we're undecided from here, to be honest.
Yeah. For me as a European, I still like being long dollar as like an anti-position to being long risk assets, for me seen from a European soil. And I think the driver, if the dollar continues up now, will be the liquidity part of the equation, as you also mentioned. If global trade slows markedly, which I find likely, then the natural source of dollar liquidity being exported via the trade deficit of the US will shrink. And that's usually something that leads to a stronger dollar. But right now, the interesting part of this equation, if we look at the broad dollar index, is what happens in the Eurozone, because the repricing of the European Central Bank has been quite remarkable lately as a consequence of the rapidly rising inflation in Europe. And in that regards, I want to touch upon the topic of commodities as well, since we've seen a renewed rally in natural gas prices today in the US. Right now, we are faced with an extreme energy situation in Europe, but this situation may carry spillovers to the US as well. What do you make of the energy situation in the US compared to Europe right now?
I mean, this is one of those things that not enough people are talking about. Like, this is just, you know, I think the general sentiment out there is that, you know, could we have seen the general sentiment of questions, and I wouldn't necessarily say sentiment, but the general tone of questions is, was that the bottom? Inflation has peaked. When is the Fed going to pivot? And there's not enough questions are being asked about, could this get worse from an inflation standpoint? Could the terminal Fed funds rate pricing go higher? Could they increase the allocations or the allotments for quantitative tightening? And these are legitimate risks. Obviously, crude oil is now breaking out again, at least on our volatility adjusted momentum signal. Clearly, food agriculture prices never really took a dip. They've been grinding higher the whole time. And then when you start to look at some inflation dynamics, and we talked about this in our morning note this morning, when you look at sort of what's been driving inflation, particularly in the last couple of months here, it's been the very aggressive slowdown in goods inflation has more than offset the continued acceleration in services inflation. If you look at it on a core goods basis, we're at 0.8% on a 3-month annualized rate. That's a big reduction. That's a big slowdown from the, let's call it 10% year-over-year rate of change that we're seeing that we last recorded in April. And you look at core services inflation, that's accelerating to 7.5%. So right now, goods is kind of taking the cake. But we know we're going to have a continued acceleration in shelter prices. That's already baked into the cake in terms of where home price appreciation is, hitting new all-time highs in March and Q1, respectively, pick your index. And so you could, if we don't slow fast enough from an economic standpoint, what's likely to happen if we continue to see a rise in crude oil, continue to see a rise in natural gas, continue to see a rise in food costs, and oh, by the way, continue to see an upward slope in services inflation, is that that stuff's going to take the baton from goods inflation and start to push inflation statistics higher on a headline basis and on a core PCE basis. And that's going to be a big, 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 big trouble for the market if that happens.
Yeah, I perfectly agree.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 Whiskey declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
We have a question in relation to the inflation pressures that we see in Europe, but also in the US now, because the big if now is whether the European Central Bank will join the hiking camp as a consequence of the inflation that we're faced with in Europe. And Manas asks whether anyone truly dares to think that the European Central Bank can hike interest rates. Do you have an opinion on that, Darius?
they can and they will. If you want to mark us up, I tweeted this to Alf the other week. If you want to cement that we're in a global slowdown, have the ECB hike interest rates. Trichet hiked them in middle of 08. He hiked them in the middle of 2011 in the European sovereign debt crisis. So when they hike interest rates, you'll know for a fact that you're probably very close to a global recession.
Yeah, it's usually how it is. And I mean, from my perspective, there is no doubt that they will join the hiking camp this summer. Yeah. The question is just whether the European markets can cope with it. One question mark being clearly related to the Italian debt sustainability. I think we're already very close to paying thresholds for the Italian debt sustainability in terms of yield spreads. So it will be a very, very tricky summer for the European Central Bank. And bear in mind that the inflation figures we got from Europe this week, if we annualize the change over the past 3 months, we are running at 16.4% inflation.
What? Wow. So that's a double versus headline.
Yeah.
Wow.
This is crazy.
I love that you do that. I love that you're out there doing real serious analysis and not just, you know, jumping from macro tourist topic to macro tourist topic. That's the kind of analysis you need to do to understand that, hey, look, the liquidity cycle not only is inflecting in Europe, it's actually going to get worse. And until that dynamic, that spread between the annualized and the year over year starts to compress and move in the other direction, you should expect to see incrementally hawkish commentary and incrementally hawkish policy actions out of the ECB.
Yeah. We have a great question from John listening to the show because basically the two of us agree that we have a slowdown ahead of us, potentially even a recession. But John is asking whether that boat is already very overcrowded. And I think that's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, so I'll say a couple things. And I have a great chart to answer that question specifically. But I'll say just something generally speaking. You know, I've been doing this for a long time and certainly back tested a lot of things. You typically don't want to be more than, and the back test will prove this. You know, once you, the markets are generally not more than 3 to 4 months forward looking. And the sweet spot is somewhere around 1 to 2 months if you look at it on a rate of change basis. So the momentum and in growth, the momentum in inflation, the momentum in policy rate exchanges, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you're talking about, you know, us being potentially a year out from the bottom of the growth cycle. I've never seen in any market cycle that I've studied or any economic cycle that I've studied, and I've studied them all as far as the data goes back, where the market bottoms this far in advance of the bottom of the growth cycle. And the only time you can actually get it to bottom, you know, 6-9 months in advance, and you look at, you know, sort of 2011 being one of the key examples, is when you get an inflection in the liquidity cycle. Well, we're very far, at least according to our analysis, from an inflection in the liquidity cycle, because we're not yet at the point of the inflation cycle that would send a signal to the Fed that they need to do something different. And so the last thing I'll say on this is, if you put up the chart up, Brian, the global downturn is not adequately priced in. What we're showing in this chart, the blue line is the OECD composite leading index time series for the global economy. So it's a proxy for global growth. the leading indicators for global growth. And the red line is the S&P 500's high beta index as a ratio to the S&P 500's low beta index. And what you've seen in the last three non-recessionary slowdowns, so I would argue COVID wasn't really a recessionary slowdown, it's just a shutdown. We got to down, let's call it 35 to 40% in this ratio. Well, we're only tracking around down to 18 to 19% right now, which is basically a half of where it needs to go. And so to say that everyone's in the boat, you know, we have not seen the kind of decline that we've historically seen in non-recessionary instances of a globally synchronized downturn, growth downturn. We could easily go into a recession at the end of this process or at any point in time in this process, which would tell you that down 35 to down 40% of that ratio is actually too bullish. So to answer the question, is everyone on one side of the boat? Yeah, but is the boat going to do anything different? That doesn't mean the boat has to flip. You know?
Yeah, and one thing I could add in that regards is the signal that we got from the investor survey Bank of America conducts every month. There's a question on the sentiment on the economy going ahead, and that sentiment is extremely bearish. But if you look at the positioning relative to that sentiment, then I would argue that the positioning is still fairly bullish on risk assets compared to the sentiment survey. So even though the sentiment is very bearish, the positioning might not be as bearish as it sounds.
Andrea,
that's worth concluding.
Thank you for saying that. I say this all the time. There's sentiment and positioning are not the same thing. You know that as an institutional guy. I know that as an institutional guy, but I don't think the average retail investor really comprehends that statement. Sentiment is what people talk about on FinTwit and what they send around surveys on. Positioning is what actually impacts the market through the options market, through the different volatility products, through et cetera, et cetera. And one final statistic that I'll leave everyone with on the positioning side of this debate, because again, sentiment is nonsensical from my perspective. If you take the ratio of household equity ownership in the United States of America, looking at the flow of funds data, and you take that and divide it as a ratio of the overall total household net worth. So what's the aggregate share of your net worth that's being contributed by stocks? It's right around 30%, or it'll be lower than 30%. This Q4 data will be lower than that in Q1. That was an all-time high. And so households in the U.S., even more than the tech bubble in 2000, were overly allocated to stocks at this most recent high in the stock market. So to say that everyone's suddenly bearish, and it may be accurate from a sentiment standpoint, they may be feeling bad, but they have not made enough of an asset allocation pivot to account for the slowdown in the growth cycle and liquidity cycle that we have ahead of us.
So let's assume for a second that we are right, that the growth cycle will continue down over the coming year and the liquidity cycle will continue down with it. From a top-down perspective, finally here, how do you position as an investor for such a scenario?
I'll give you one quick answer for that. Sign up for 42 Macro if you want the portfolio construction.
Then I can say at least it's worth having a few bonds in your portfolio in such a scenario. I think we will leave you with those comments for today. Thanks very much.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.